10. It was a storage area, much bigger than Jake had expected, almost as big as a warehouse, and stacked high with books in every direction. He guessed that some of those stacks, held in place by pairs of upright beams that provided shoring rather than shelving, had to be 14 or 16 feet high. Narrow, crooked aisles ran between them. In a couple, he saw rolling platforms that made him think of the portable boarding ramps you saw in smaller airports. The smell of old books was the same back here as in front, but ever so much stronger, almost overwhelming. Above them hung a scattering of shaded lamps that provided yellowish, uneven illumination. The shadows of Tower, Balazar, and Balazar's friends leaped grotesquely on the wall to their left. Tower turned that way, leading his visitors to a corner that really was an office. There was a desk with a typewriter and a Rolodex on it, 3 old filing cabinets, and a wall covered with various pieces of paperwork. There was a calendar with some 19th-century guy on a May sheet Jake didn't recognize. And then he did. Robert Browning. Jake had quoted him in his final essay. Tower sat down in the chair behind his desk and immediately seemed sorry he'd done that. Jake could sympathize. The way the other 3 crowded around him couldn't have been very pleasant. Their shadows jumped up the wall behind the desk like the shadows of gargoyles. Balazar reached into his suit coat and brought out a folded sheet of paper. He opened it and put it down on Tower's desk. "Recognize this?" Eddie moved forward. Jake grabbed at him.
"Don't go close. They'll sense you."
"I don't care," Eddie said. "I need to see that paper." Jake followed, not knowing what else to do. Oi stirred in his arms and whined. Jake shushed him curtly, and Oi blinked.
"Sorry, buddy," Jake said, "but you have to keep quiet."
Was the 1977 version of him in the vacant lot yet? Once inside it, that earlier Jake had slipped somehow and knocked himself unconscious. Had that happened yet? No sense wondering. Eddie was right. Jake didn't like it, but he knew it was true. They were supposed to be here, not there, and they were supposed to see the paper Balazar was now showing Calvin Tower. 11. Eddie got the first couple of lines before Jack Andolini said,
"Boss, I don't like this. Something feels hinky."
Balazar nodded. "I agree. Is someone back here with us, Mr. Torrin?" He still sounded calm and courteous, but his eyes were everywhere, assessing this large room's potential for concealment.
"No," Tower said. "Well, there's Sergio. He's the shop cat. I imagine he's back here somewhere."
"This ain't no shop," Biondi said. "It's a hole you pour money into. One of those she-she designers that have trouble making enough to cover the overhead on a joint this big. And a bookstore? Man, who are you kidding?"
Himself, that's who, Eddie thought. He's been kidding himself. As if this thought had summoned them, those terrible chimes began again. The hoods gathered in Tower's storeroom office didn't hear them, but Jake and Oi did. Eddie could read it on their distressed faces, and suddenly this room, already dim, began to grow dimmer still.
"We're going back," Eddie thought. "Jesus, we're going back. But not before."
He bent forward between Andolini and Balazar, aware that both men were looking around with wide, wary eyes, not caring. What he cared about was the paper. Someone had hired Balazar first to get it signed, probably, and then to shove it under Tower Torin's nose when the time was right, certainly. In most cases, Il Roche would have been content to send a couple of his hard boys, what he called his gentlemen, on an errand like that. This job, however, was important enough to warrant his personal attention. Eddie wanted to know why.
Memorandum of Agreement. This document constitutes a pact of agreement between Mr. Calvin Tower, a New York State resident, owning real property which is principally a vacant lot, identified as lot number 298 and block number 19, located... Those chimes wriggled through his head again, making him shiver. This time they were louder. The shadows drew thicker, leaping up the storage room's walls. The darkness Eddie had sensed out on the street was breaking through. They might be swept away, and that would be bad. They might be drowned in it, and that would be worse. Of course it would. Being drowned in darkness would surely be an awful way to go. And suppose there were things in that darkness.
hungry things like the doorkeeper.
There are.
That was Henry's voice. For the first time in almost 2 months, Eddie could imagine Henry standing just behind him and grinning a sallow junkie's grin, all bloodshot eyes and yellow, uncared-for teeth.
You know there are. But when you hear the chimes, you gotta go, bro, as I think you know.
Eddie, Jake cried, it's coming back, do you hear it? Grab my belt, Eddie said. His eyes raced back and forth over the paper in Tower's pudgy hands. Balazar, Andolini, and Big Nose were still looking around. Biondi had actually drawn his gun.
Maybe we won't be separated, Eddie said.
The chimes were louder than ever, and he groaned. The words of the agreement blurred in front of him. Eddie squinted his eyes, bringing the print back together.
Identified as lot number 298 and block number 19, located in Manhattan, New York City, on 46th Street and 2nd Avenue, and Sombra Corporation, a corporation doing business within the state of New York. On this day of July 15, 1976, Sombra is paying a non-returnable sum of $100,000 to Calvin Tower, receipt of which is acknowledged in regard to this property. In consideration thereof, Calvin Tower agrees not to...
July 15, 1976, not quite a year ago. Eddie felt the darkness sweeping down on them and tried to cram the rest of it through his eyes and into his brain, enough maybe to make sense of what was going on here. If he could do that, it would be at least a step toward figuring out what all this meant to them. If the chimes don't drive me crazy. If the things in the darkness don't eat us on the way back.
Eddie!
Jake. And terrified by the sound, Eddie ignored him.
Calvin Tower agrees not to sell or lease or otherwise encumber the property during a 1-year period commencing on the date hereof and ending on July 15, 1977. It is understood that the Sombra Corporation shall have first right of purchase on the above-mentioned property as defined below. During this period, Calvin Tower will fully preserve and protect Sombra Corporation's stated interest in the above-mentioned property and will permit no liens or other encumbrances.
There was more, but now the chimes were hideous, head-bursting. For just one moment, Eddie understood, hell, could almost see how thin this world had become, all of the worlds, probably, as thin and worn as his own jeans. He caught one final phrase from the agreement. If these conditions are met, we'll have the right to sell or otherwise dispose of the property to Sombra or any other party. Then the words were gone. Everything was gone, spinning into a black whirlpool. Jake held onto Eddie's belt with one hand and Oi with the other. Oi was barking wildly now, and Eddie had another confused image of Dorothy being swirled away to the land of Oz. There were things in the darkness, looming shapes behind weird phosphorescent eyes, the sort of things you saw in movies about exploring the deepest cracks of the ocean floor. Except in those movies, the explorers were always inside a steel diving bell, while he and Jake... The chimes grew to an ear-splitting volume. Eddie felt as if he had been jammed headfirst into the works of Big Ben as it was striking midnight. He screamed without hearing himself, and then... It was gone. Everything was all gone. Jake, Oi, Midworld, and he was floating somewhere beyond the stars and the galaxies. "Susanna," he cried. "Where are you, Suze?" No answer. Only darkness.
Chapter 3. Mia. 1. Once upon a time, back in the 60s, before the world moved on, there had been a woman named Odetta Holmes, a pleasant and really quite socially conscious young woman who was wealthy, good-looking, and perfectly willing to look out for the other guy, or gal. Without even realizing it, this woman shared her body with a far less pleasant creature named Detta Walker. Detta did not give a tin shit for the other guy, or gal. Rhea of the Coos would have recognized Detta and called her sister. On the other side of Midworld, Roland of Gilead, the last gunslinger, had drawn this divided woman to him and had created a third who was far better, far stronger, than either of the previous two. This was the woman with whom Eddie Dean had fallen in love. She called him husband, and thus herself, by the name of his father. Having missed the feminist squabbles of later decades, she did this quite happily. If she did not call herself Susanna Dean with pride as well as happiness, it was only because her mother had taught her that pride goeth before a fall. Now there was a fourth woman. She had been born out of the third in yet another time of stress and change. She cared nothing for Odetta, Detta, or Susanna. She cared for nothing save the new chap who was on his way. The new chap needed to be fed. The banqueting hall was near. That was what mattered, and all that mattered.
This new woman, every bit as dangerous in her own way as Detta Walker had been, was Mia. She bore the name of no man's father. Only the word that in the high speech means mother.
2. She walked slowly down long stone corridors toward the place of feasting. She walked past the rooms of ruin, past the empty naves and niches, past forgotten galleries where the apartments were hollow and none was the number. Somewhere in this castle stood an old throne drenched in ancient blood. Somewhere ladderways led to bone-walled crypts that went gods knew how deep. Yet there was life here, life and rich food. Mia knew this as well as she knew the legs under her and the textured, many-layered skirt swishing against them. Rich food. Life for you and for your crop, as the saying went. And she was so hungry now. Of course. Wasn't she eating for two? She came to a broad staircase. A sound, faint but powerful, rose up to her. The beat, beat, beat of slow-trans engines buried in the earth below the deepest of the crypts. Mia cared nothing for them, nor for North Central Positronics Limited, which had built them and set them in motion tens of thousands of years before. She cared nothing for the dipolar computers, or the doors, or the beams, or the dark tower which stood at the center of everything.
What she cared about was the smells. They drifted up to her, thick and wonderful. Chicken and gravy and roasts of pork dressed in suits of crackling fat. Sides of beef beaded with blood, wheels of moist cheese. Huge calafundi shrimp like plump orange commas. Split fish with staring black eyes, their bellies brimming with sauce. Great pots of jambalaya and finata, the vast caldo largo stews of the far south. Add to this 100 fruits and 1,000 sweets, and still you were only at the beginning. The appetizers, the first mouthfuls of the first course.
Mia ran quickly down the broad central staircase, the skin of her palm skimming silkily along the banister, her small slippered feet stuttering on the steps. Once she'd had a dream that she had been pushed in front of an underground train by an awful man, and her legs had been cut off at the knee. But dreams are foolish. Her feet were there, and the legs above them, weren't they? Yes. And so was the babe in her belly. The chap, wanting to be fed. He was hungry. And so was she. 3. From the foot of the stairs, a wide corridor floored with polished black marble ran 90 feet to a pair of tall double doors. Mia hurried that way. She saw her reflection floating below her and the electric flambeau that burned in the depths of the marble like torches underwater, but she did not see the man who came along behind her. Descending the sweeping curve of the stairs, not in dress pumps, but in old and range-battered boots. He wore faded jeans and a shirt of blue chambray instead of court clothes. One gun, a pistol with a worn sandalwood grip, hung at his left side, the holster tied down with rawhide. His face was tanned and lined and weathered. His hair was black, although now seeded with growing streaks of white. His eyes were his most striking feature. They were blue and cold and steady. Detta Walker had feared no man, not even this one. But she had feared those shooter's eyes. There was a foyer just before the double doors. It was floored with red and black marble squares. The wood-paneled walls were hung with faded portraits of old lords and ladies. In the center was a statue made of entwined rose marble and chrome steel. It seemed to be a knight-errant with what might have been a six-gun or a short sword raised above his head. Although the face was mostly smooth, the sculptor had done no more than hint at the features. Mia knew who it was, right enough. Who it must be.
"I salute thee, Arthur Eld," she said, and dropped her deepest curtsy. "Please bless these things I'm about to take to my use, and to the use of my chap. Good evening to you." She could not wish him long days upon the earth, for his days and those of most of his kind were gone. Instead, she touched her smiling lips with the tips of her fingers and blew him a kiss. Having made her manners, she walked into the dining hall.
It was 40 yards wide and 70 yards long, that room. Brilliant electric torches and crystal sheaths lined both sides. Hundreds of chairs stood in place at a vast ironwood table laden with delicacies both hot and cold. There was a white plate with delicate blue webbing, a four special plate, in front of each chair. The chairs were empty, the four special banquet plates were empty, and the wine glasses were empty, although the wine to fill them stood in golden buckets at intervals along the table, chilled and ready. It was as she had known it would be, as she had seen it in her fondest, clearest imaginings, as she had found it again and again and would find it as long as she and the chap needed it. Wherever she found herself, this castle was near. And if there was a smell of dampness and ancient mud, what of that? If there were scuttering sounds from the shadows under the table, mayhap the sound of rats or even Fortnoy weasels, why should she care? Above table, all was lush and lighted, fragrant and ripe and ready for taking. Let the shadows below table take care of themselves. That was none of her business. No, none of hers.
"Here comes Mia, daughter of Nun," she called gaily to the silent room with its 100 aromas of meats and sauces and creams and fruits. "I am hungry and I will be fed. Moreover, I'll feed my chap. If anyone would say against me, let him step forward. Let me see him very well, and he me."
No one stepped forward, of course. Those who might once have banqueted here were long gone. Now there was only the deep and sleepy beat of the slow trans engines, and those faint and unpleasant scampering sounds from the land of Undertable. Behind her, the gunslinger stood quietly watching. Nor was it for the first time. He saw no castle, but he saw her. He saw her very well.
"Silence gives consent," she called.
She pressed her hand to her belly, which had begun to protrude outward, to curve. Then with a laugh she cried,
"Aye, so it does. Here comes Mia to the feast. May it serve both her and the chap who grows inside her. May it serve them very well."
And she did feast. But not in one place, and never from one of the plates. She hated the plates. The white and blue four specials. She didn't know why, and didn't care to know. What she cared about was the food. She walked along the table like a woman at the world's grandest buffet, taking things with her fingers and tossing them into her mouth, sometimes chewing meat hot and tender right off the bone before slinging the joints back onto their serving platters. A few times she missed these, and the chunks of meat would go rolling across the white linen tablecloth, leaving splotches of juice in nosebleed stains. One of these rolling roasts overturned a gravy boat. One smashed a crystal serving dish filled with cranberry jelly. A third rolled clean off the far side of the table, where Mia heard something drag it underneath. There was a brief squealing squabble, followed by a howl of pain, as something sank its teeth into something else. Then, silence. It was brief, though, and soon broken by Mia's laughter, she wiped her greasy fingers on her bosom, doing it slowly, enjoying the way the stains of the mixed meats and juices spread on the expensive silk, enjoying the ripening curves of her breasts and the feel of her nipples under her fingertips, rough and hard and excited. She made her way slowly down the table, talking to herself in many voices, creating a kind of lunatic chit-chat.
"How they hanging, honey?" "Oh, they're hanging just fine. Thank you so much for asking, Mia. Do you really believe that Oswald was working alone when he shot Kennedy?" "Never in a million years, darling. That was a CIA job the whole way. Them are those honky millionaires from the Alabama Steel Crescent. Birmingham, Alabama, honey? Ain't it the truth? Have you heard the new Joan Baez record? My God, yes. Doesn't she sing like an angel? I hear that she and Bob Dylan are going to get themselves married."
And on, chitter and chatter. Roland heard Odetta's cultured voice and Detta's rough but colorful profanity. He heard Susanna's voice and many others as well. How many women in her head, how many personalities, formed and half-formed. He watched her reach over the empty plates that weren't there and empty glasses, also not there, eating directly from the serving platters, chewing everything with the same hungry relish, her face gradually picking up the shine of grease, the bodice of her gown, which he did not see but sensed, darkening as she wiped her fingers there again and again, squeezing the cloth, matting it against her breasts. These motions were too clear to mistake. And at each stop, before moving on, she would seize the empty air in front of her and throw a plate he could not see either on the floor at her feet or across the table at a wall that must exist in her dream. "There," she'd scream in the defiant voice of Detta Walker, "there, you nasty old blue lady, I done broke it again, I broke your fucking plate, and how do you like it? How do you like it now?" Then, stepping to the next place, she might utter a pleasant but restrained little trill of laughter and ask so-and-so how their boy so-and-so was coming along down there at Morehouse, and wasn't it wonderful to have such a fine school for people of color, just the most wonderful thing, and how is your mama, dear? Oh, I am so sorry to hear it. We'll all be praying for her recovery. Reaching across another of those make-believe plates as she spoke, grabbing up a great tureen filled with glistening black roe and lemon rinds, lowering her face into it like a hog dropping its face into the trough. Gobbling. Raising her face again, smiling delicately and demurely in the glow of the electric torches, the fish eggs standing out like black sweat on her brown skin, dotting her cheeks and her brow, nestling around her nostrils like clots of old blood. "Oh, yes, I think we are making wonderful progress. Folks like that Bull Connor are living in the sunset years now, and the best revenge on them is that they know it." And then she would throw the tureen backward over her head like a crazed volleyball player, some of the roe raining down in her hair. Roland could almost see it. And when the tureen smashed against the stone, her polite "isn't this a wonderful party" face would cramp into a ghoulish Detta Walker snarl, and she might scream, "There, you nasty old blue lady, how'd I feel? You want to stick some of that caviar up your dry-ass cunt, you go on and do it. You go right on. That'd be fine show." And then she would move on to the next place, and the next, feeding herself in the great banquet hall, feeding herself and feeding her chap, never turning to see Roland at all, never realizing that this place did not, strictly speaking, even exist. 4. Eddie and Jake had been far from Roland's mind and concerns as the four of them, five if Oi was counted, bedded down after feasting on the fried muffin balls. He had been focused on Susanna. The gunslinger was quite sure she would go wandering again tonight, and again he would follow after her when she did. Not to see what she was up to. He knew what it would be in advance. No, his chief purpose had been protection. Early that afternoon, around the time Jake had returned with his armload of food, Susanna had begun to show signs Roland knew. Speech that was clipped and short, movements that were a little too jerky to be graceful, an absent tendency to rub at her temple or above her left eyebrow as if there was a pain there. Did Eddie not see those signs? Roland wondered. Eddie had been a dull observer indeed when Roland first met him, but he had changed greatly since then, and he loved her. Loved her. How could he, and not see what Roland saw? The signs weren't quite as obvious as they had been on the beach at the edge of the Western Sea, when Detta was preparing to leap forward and wrest control from Odetta, but they were there all right, and not so different at that. On the other hand, Roland's mother had had a saying, "Love stumbles." It could be that Eddie was simply too close to her to see. Or doesn't want to, Roland thought. Doesn't want to face the idea that we might have to go through that whole business again. The business of making her face herself and her divided nature. Except this time it wasn't about her. Roland had suspected this for a long time, since before their palaver with the people of River Crossing, in fact, and now he knew. No, it wasn't about her. And so he'd lain there, listening to their breathing lengthen as they dropped off one by one. Oi, then Jake, then Susanna. Eddie last. Well, not quite last. Faintly, very faintly, Roland could hear a murmur of conversation from the folk on the other side of yonder south hill, the ones who were trailing them and watching them. Nerving themselves to step forward and make themselves known, very likely. Roland's ears were sharp, but not quite sharp enough to pick out what they were saying. There were perhaps half a dozen murmured exchanges before someone uttered a loud, shushing hiss. Then there was silence, except for the low, intermittent snuffling of the wind in the treetops. Roland lay still, looking up into the darkness where no stars shone, waiting for Susanna to rise. Eventually she did. But before that, Jake, Eddie, and Oi went toe-dash. 5. Roland and his mates had learned about toe-dash, what there was to learn, from Vanney, the tutor of court in the long ago when they had been young. They had been a quintet to begin with, Roland, Alain, Cuthbert, Jamie, and Wallace, Vanney's son. Wallace, fiercely intelligent but ever sickly, had died of the falling sickness, sometimes called King's Evil. Then they had been four, and under the umbrella of True Quartet. Vanney had known it as well, and that knowing was surely part of his sorrow. Court taught them to navigate by the sun and stars. Vanney showed them compass and quadrant and sextant and taught them the mathematics necessary to use them. Court taught them to fight. With history, logic problems, and tutorials on what he called the universal truths, Vanney taught them how they could sometimes avoid having to do so. Court taught them to kill if they had to. Vanney, with his limp and his sweet but distracted smile, taught them that violence worsened problems far more often than it solved them. He called it the hollow chamber, where all true sounds became distorted by echoes. He taught them physics. What physics there was. He taught them chemistry, what chemistry was left. He taught them to finish such sentences as, "That tree is like a," and, "When I'm running I feel as happy as a," and, "We couldn't help laughing because..." Roland hated these exercises, but Vanney wouldn't let him slip away from them. "Your imagination is a poor thing, Roland," the tutor told him once. Roland might have been 11 at the time. "I will not let you feed it short rations and make it poorer still." He had taught them the 7 dials of magic, refusing to say if he believed in any of them, and Roland thought it was tangential to one of these lessons that Vanney had mentioned toe-dash. Or perhaps you capitalized it. Perhaps it was toe-dash. Roland didn't know for sure. He knew that Vanney had spoken of the Mani sect, people who were far travelers. And hadn't he also mentioned the wizard's rainbow? Roland thought, yes, but he had twice had the pink bend of the rainbow in his own possession, once as a boy and once as a man. And although he had traveled in it both times, with his friends on the second occasion, it had never taken him toe-dash. "Ah, but how would you know?" he asked himself. "How would you know, Roland, when you were inside it? because Cuthbert and Hélène would have told him that was why.
Are you sure?
Some feeling, so strange as to be unidentifiable, rose in the gunslinger's bosom. Was it indignation? Horror? Perhaps even a sense of betrayal? As he realized that, no, he wasn't sure. All he knew was that the ball had taken him deep into itself, and he had been lucky to ever get out again. There's no ball here, he thought. And again it was that other voice, the dry, implacable voice of his old limping tutor, whose grief for his only son had never really ended, that answered him, and the words were the same. Are you sure? Gunslinger, are you sure?
6.
It started with a low, crackling sound. Roland's first thought was the campfire. One of them had gotten some green fir boughs in there, the coals had finally reached them, and they were producing that sound as the needles smoldered. But the sound grew louder, became a kind of electric buzzing. Roland sat up and looked across the dying fire. His eyes widened, and his heart began to speed up. Susanna had turned from Eddie, had drawn away a little too. Eddie had reached out, and so had Jake. Their hands touched. And as Roland looked at them, they commenced fading in and out of existence in a series of jerky pulses. Oi was doing the same thing. When they were gone, they were replaced by a dull gray glow that approximated the shapes and positions of their bodies, as if something was holding their places in reality. Each time they came back, it would be that crackling buzz. Roland could see their closed eyelids ripple as the balls rolled beneath. Dreaming, but not just dreaming. This was Todash, the passing between two worlds. Supposedly, the Mani could do it. And supposedly, some pieces of the wizard's rainbow could make you do it, whether you wanted to or not. One piece of it in particular. They could get caught between and fall, Roland thought. Vanay said that, too. He said that going Todash was full of peril. What else had he said? Roland had no time to recall, for at that moment Susanna sat up, slipped the soft leather caps Roland had made her over the stumps of her legs, then hoisted herself into her wheelchair. A moment later she was rolling toward the ancient trees on the north side of the road. It was directly away from the place where the watchers were camped. There was that much to be grateful for. Roland stayed where he was for a moment, torn. But in the end, his course was clear enough. He couldn't wake them up while they were in the Todash state. To do so would be a horrible risk. All he could do was follow Susanna, as he had on other nights, and hope she didn't get herself into trouble. You might also do some thinking about what happens next. That was Vanay's dry, lecturely voice. Now that his old tutor was back, he apparently meant to stay for a while. Reason was never your strong point, but you must do it nevertheless. You'll want to wait until your visitors make themselves known, of course. Until you can be sure of what they want, but eventually, Roland, you must act. Think first, however. Sooner would be better than later.
Yes, sooner was always better than later.
There was another loud, buzzing crackle. Eddie and Jake were back. Jake lying with his arm curled around Oi, and then they were gone again, nothing left where they had been but a faint ectoplasmic shimmer. Well, never mind. His job was to follow Susanna. As for Eddie and Jake, there would be water if God willed it. Suppose you come back here and they're gone. It happens, Vanay said so. What will you tell her if she wakes and finds them both gone, her husband and her adopted son? It was nothing he could worry about now. Right now, there was Susanna to worry about. Susanna to keep safe.
7.
On the north side of the road, old trees with enormous trunks stood at considerable distances from each other. Their branches might entwine and create a solid canopy overhead, but at ground level there was plenty of room for Susanna's wheelchair, and she moved along at a good pace, weaving between the vast ironwoods and pines, rolling downhill over a fragrant duff of mulch and needles. Not Susanna. Not Detta or Odetta either. This one calls herself Mia. Roland didn't care if she called herself Queen of Green Days, as long as she came back safe, and the other two were still there when she did. He began to smell a brighter, fresher green, reeds and water weeds. With it came the smell of mud, the thump of frogs, the sarcastic hool-hool salute of an owl, the splash of water as something jumped. This was followed by a thin shriek as something died, maybe the jumper, maybe the jumped upon. Underbrush began to spring up in the duff, first dotting it and then crowding it out. The tree cover thinned. Mosquitoes and chiggers whined. Binny bugs stitched the air. The bog smells grew stronger. The wheels of the chair had passed over the duff without leaving any trace. As duff gave way to straggling low growth, Roland began to see broken twigs and torn-off leaves marking her passage. Then, as she reached the more or less level low ground, the wheels began to sink into the increasingly soft earth. 20 paces farther on, he began to see liquid seeping into the tracks. She was too wise to get stuck, though, too crafty. 20 paces beyond the first signs of seepage, he came to the wheelchair itself. Abandoned. Lying on the seat were her pants and shirt. She had gone on into the bog naked, save for the leather caps that covered her stumps. Down here there were ribbons of mist hanging over puddles of standing water. Grassy hummocks rose. On one, wired to a dead log that had been planted upright, was what Roland at first took for an ancient stuffy guy. When he got closer, he saw it was a human skeleton. The skull's forehead had been smashed inward, leaving a triangle of darkness between the staring sockets. Some sort of primitive war club had made that wound, no doubt, and the corpse, or its lingering spirit, had been left to mark this as the edge of some tribe's territory. They were probably long dead or moved on, but caution was ever a virtue. Roland drew his gun and continued after the woman, stepping from hummock to hummock, wincing at the occasional jab of pain in his right hip. It took all his concentration and agility to keep up with her. Partly this was because she hadn't Roland's interest in staying as dry as possible. She was as naked as a mermaid and moved like one, as comfortable in the muck and swamp ooze as on dry land. She crawled over the larger hummocks, slid through the water between them, pausing every now and then to pick off a leech. In the darkness, the walking and sliding seemed to merge into a single slithering motion that was eerily and disturbing. She went on perhaps a quarter of a mile into the increasingly oozy bog, with the gunslinger following patiently along behind her. He kept as quiet as possible, although he doubted if there was any need. The part of her that saw and felt and thought was far from here. At last she came to a halt, standing on her truncated legs and holding to tough tangles of brush on either side in order to keep her balance. She looked out over the black surface of a pond, head up, body still. The gunslinger couldn't tell if the pond was big or small. Its borders were lost in the mist. Yet there was light here, some sort of faint and unfocused radiance, which seemed to lie just beneath the surface of the water itself, perhaps emanating from submerged and slowly rotting logs. She stood there, surveying this muck-crusted woodland pond, like a queen surveying a what? What did she see? A banquet hall? That was what he had come to believe, almost to see. It was a whisper from her mind to his, and it dovetailed with what she said and did. The banqueting hall was her mind's ingenious way of keeping Susanna apart from Mia, as it had kept Odetta apart from Detta all those years. Mia might have any number of reasons for wanting to keep her existence a secret, but surely the greatest of these had to do with the life she carried inside her. The chap, she called it. Then, with a suddenness that still startled him, although he had seen this before as well, she began to hunt, slipping in eerie splashless silence, first along the edge of the pond and then a little way out into it. Roland watched her with an expression that contained both horror and lust as she knitted and wove her way in and out of the reeds, between and over the tussocks. Now, instead of picking the leeches off her skin and throwing them away, she tossed them into her mouth, like pieces of candy. The muscles in her thighs rippled. Her brown skin gleamed like wet silk. When she turned, Roland had by this time stepped behind a tree and become one of the shadows, he could clearly see the way her breasts had ripened. The problem, of course, extended beyond the chap. There was Eddie to consider as well. "What the hell's wrong with you, Roland?" Roland could hear him saying. "That might be our kid. I mean, you can't know for sure that it isn't." Yeah, I know something had her while we were yanking Jake through, but that doesn't necessarily mean—" On and on and on, blah, 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 as Eddie himself might say. And why? Because he loved her, and would want the child of their union. And because arguing came as naturally to Eddie Dean as breathing. Cuthbert had been the same. In the reeds, a naked woman's hand pistoned forward and seized a good-sized frog. She squeezed, and the frog popped, squirting guts and a shiny load of eggs between her fingers. Its head burst. She lifted it to her mouth and ate it greedily down while its greenish-white rear legs still twitched, licking the blood and shiny ropes of tissue from her knuckles. Then she mimed throwing something down and cried out, "How you like that, you stinking blue lady?" in a low, guttural voice that made Roland shiver. It was Detta Walker's voice. Detta at her meanest and craziest. With hardly a pause, she moved on again, questing. Next, it was a small fish, then another frog, and then a real prize, a water rat that squeaked and writhed and tried to bite. She crushed the life out of it and stuffed it into her mouth, paws and all. A moment later, she bent her head down and regurgitated the waste, a twisted mass of fur and splintered bones. Show him this, then. Always assuming that he and Jake get back from whatever adventure they're on, that is, and say, "I know that women are supposed to have strange cravings when they carry a child, Eddie, but doesn't this seem a little too strange? Look at her, questing through the reeds and ooze like some sort of human alligator. Look at her and tell me she's doing that in order to feed your child. Any human child." Still, he would argue. Roland knew it. What he didn't know was what Susanna herself might do when Roland told her she was growing something that craved raw meat in the middle of the night. And as if this business wasn't worrisome enough, now there was Todash, and strangers who had come looking for them. Yet the strangers were the least of his problems. In fact, he found their presence almost comforting. He didn't know what they wanted, and yet he did know. He had met them before, many times. At bottom, they always wanted the same thing. 8. Now the woman who called herself Mia began to talk as she hunted. Roland was familiar with this part of her ritual as well, but it chilled him nevertheless. He was looking right at her, and it was still hard to believe all those different voices could be coming from the same throat. She asked herself how she was. She told herself she was doing fine, thank you so very much. She spoke of someone named Bill, or perhaps it was Bull. She asked after someone's mother. She asked someone about a place called Morehouse. And then, in a deep, gravelly voice, a man's voice, beyond doubt, she told herself that she didn't go to Morehouse or no house. She laughed raucously at this, so it must have been some sort of joke. She introduced herself several times, as she had on other nights, as Mia, a name Roland knew well from his early life in Gilead. It was almost a holy name. Twice she curtsied, lifting invisible skirts in a way that tugged at the gunslinger's heart. He had first seen that sort of curtsy in Mages, when he and his friends, Alan and Cuthbert, had been sent there by their fathers. She worked her way back to the edge of the hall, pond, glistening and wet. She stayed there without moving for 5 minutes, then 10. The owl uttered its derisive salute again, "Hoo!" And as if in response, the moon came out of the clouds for a brief look around. When it did, some small animal's bit of shady concealment disappeared. It tried to dart past the woman. She snared it faultlessly and plunged her face into its writhing belly.
There was a wet, crunching noise, followed by several smacking bites. She held the remains up in the moonlight, her dark hands and wrists darker with its blood. Then she tore it in half and bolted down the remains. She gave a resounding belch and rolled herself back into the water. This time she made a great splash, and Roland knew tonight's banqueting was done. She had even eaten some of the binny bugs, snatching them effortlessly out of the air. He could only hope nothing she'd taken in would sicken her. So far nothing had. While she made her rough toilet, washing off the mud and blood, Roland retreated back the way he'd come, ignoring the more frequent pains in his hip and moving with all his guile. He had watched her go through this three times before, and once had been enough to see how gruesomely sharp her senses were while in this state. He paused at her wheelchair, looking around to make sure he'd left no trace of himself. He saw a boot print, smoothed it away, then tossed a few leaves over it for good measure. Not too many. Too many might be worse than none at all. With that done, he headed back toward the road in their camp, not hurrying any more. She would pause for a little housekeeping of her own before going on. What would Mia see as she was cleaning Susanna's wheelchair, he wondered? Some sort of small motorized cart? It didn't matter. What did was how clever she was. If he hadn't awakened with a need to make water just as she left on one of her earlier expeditions, he quite likely still wouldn't know about her hunting trips, and he was supposed to be clever about such things.
Not as clever as she, maggot.
Now, as if the ghost of Vanet were not enough, here was Court to lecture him.
She's shown you before, hasn't she?
Yes. She had shown him cleverness as three women. Now, there was this fourth. 9. When Roland saw the break in the trees ahead, the road they'd been following, and the place where they'd camped for the night, he took two long, deep breaths. These were meant to steady him, and didn't succeed very well. Water, if God wills it, he reminded himself. About the great matters, Roland, you have no say. Not a comfortable truth, especially for a man on a quest such as his, but one he'd learned to live with. He took another breath, then stepped out. He released the air in a long, relieved sigh as he saw Eddie and Jake lying deeply asleep beside the dead fire. Jake's right hand, which had been linked with Eddie's left when the gunslinger had followed Susanna out of camp, now circled Oi's body. The bumbler opened one eye and regarded Roland. Then he closed it again. Roland couldn't hear her coming, but sensed her just the same. He lay down quickly, rolled over onto his side, and put his face in the crook of his elbow. And from this position, he watched as the wheelchair rolled out of the trees. She had cleaned it quickly, but well. Roland couldn't see a single spot of mud. The spokes gleamed in the moonlight. She parked the chair where it had been before, slipped out of it with her usual grace, and moved across to where Eddie lay. Roland watched her approach her husband's sleeping form with some anxiety. Anyone, he thought, who had met Detta Walker would have felt that anxiety, because the woman who called herself mother was simply too close to what Detta had been. Lying completely still, like one in sleep's deepest sling, Roland prepared himself to move. Then she brushed the hair back from the side of Eddie's face and kissed the hollow of his temple. The tenderness in that gesture told the gunslinger all he needed to know. It was safe to sleep. He closed his eyes and let the darkness take him.
Chapter 4 Palaver 1 When Roland woke in the morning, Susanna was still asleep, but Eddie and Jake were up. Eddie had built a small new fire on the gray bones of the old one. He and the boys sat close to it for the warmth, eating what Eddie called gunslinger burritos. They looked both excited and worried. "Roland," Eddie said, "I think we need to talk. Something happened to us last night."
"I know," Roland said. "I saw. You went Todash."
"Todash?" Jake asked. "What's that?" Roland started to tell them, then shook his head.
If we're going to palaver, Eddie, you'd better wake Susanna up. That way, we won't have to double back over the first part. He glanced south. And hopefully our new friends won't interrupt us until we've had our talk. They're none of this. But already he was wondering about that. He watched with more than ordinary interest as Eddie shook Susanna awake, quite sure, but by no means positive, that it would be Susanna who opened her eyes. It was. She sat up, stretched, ran her fingers through her tight curls.
"What's your problem, honey child? I was good for another hour, at least."
"We need to talk, Sus," Eddie said.
"Oh, you want, but not quite yet," she said. "God, but I'm stiff."
"Sleeping on hard ground will do it every time," Eddie said. Not to mention hunting, naked, in the bogs and damps, Roland thought.
"Pour me some water, Shug."
She held out her palms, and Eddie filled them with water from one of the skins. She dashed this over her cheeks and into her eyes, gave out a little shivery cry, and said, "Cold."
"Old,"
Oi said.
"Not yet," she told the bumbler, "but you give me a few more months like the last few and I will be.
Roland, you mid-world folks know about coffee, right?" Roland nodded. "From the plantations of the Outer Ark, down south."
"If we come across some, we'll hook it, won't we? You promise me now."
"I promise," Roland said. Susanna, meanwhile, was studying Eddie.
"What's going on? You boys don't look so good."
"More dreams," Eddie said.
"Me too," Jake said.
"Not dreams," the gunslinger said. "Susanna, how did you sleep?" She looked at him candidly. Roland did not sense even the shadow of a lie in her answer.
"Like a rock, as I usually do. One thing all this traveling is good for, you can throw your damn Nembutal away."
"What's this toadish thing, Roland?" Eddie asked. "Toadash," he said, and explained it to them as well as he could. What he remembered best from Vanay's teachings was how the Mani spent long periods fasting in order to induce the right state of mind, and how they traveled around looking for exactly the right spot in which to induce the Toadash state. This was something they determined with magnets and large plumb bobs.
"Sounds to me like these guys would have been right at home down in Needle Park," Eddie said.
"Anywhere in Greenwich Village," Susanna added.
"Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it?"
Jake said in a grave, deep voice, and they all laughed. Even Roland laughed a little.
"Toadash is another way of traveling," Eddie said when the laughter had stopped. "Like the doors and the glass balls, is that right?"
Roland started to say yes, then hesitated. "I think they might all be variations of the same thing," he said. "And according to Vanay, the glass balls, the pieces of the wizard's rainbow, make going Toadash easier. Sometimes too easy." Jake said,
"We really flickered on and off like light bulbs, what you call spark lights?"
"Yes. You appeared and disappeared. When you were gone, there was a dim glow where you'd been, almost as if something were holding your place for you."
"Thank God if it was," Eddie said. "When it ended, when those chimes started playing again and we kicked loose, I'll tell you the truth, I didn't think we were going to get back."
"Neither did I," Jake said quietly. The sky had clouded over again, and in the dull morning light the boy looked very pale.
"I lost you." "I was never so glad to see any place in my life as I was when I opened my eyes and saw this little piece of road," Eddie said. "And you beside me, Jake. Even Rover looked good to me."
He glanced at Oi, then over at Susanna.
"Nothing like this happened to you last night, hon?"
"We'd have seen her," Jake said.
"Not if she'd toe-dashed off to someplace else," Eddie said.
Susanna shook her head, looking troubled.
"I just slept the night away, as I told you. What about you, Roland?"
"Nothing to report," Roland said. As always, he would keep his own counsel, until his instinct told him it was time to share. And besides, what he'd said wasn't exactly a lie. He looked keenly at Eddie and Jake. "There's trouble, isn't there?" Eddie and Jake looked at each other, then back at Roland. Eddie sighed.
"Yeah, probably."
"How bad, do you know?"
"I don't think we do. Do we, Jake?"
Jake shook his head.
"But I've got some ideas," Eddie went on, "and if I'm right, we've got a problem, a big one."
He swallowed, hard.
Jake touched his hand, and the gunslinger was concerned to see how quickly and firmly Eddie took hold of the boy's fingers. Roland reached out and drew Susanna's hand into his own. He had a brief vision of that hand seizing a frog and squeezing the guts out of it. He put it out of his mind. The woman who had done that was not here now. "Tell us," he said to Eddie and Jake, "tell us everything. We would hear it all."
"Every word," Susanna agreed, "for your father's sakes."
2. They recounted what had happened to them in the New York of 1977. Roland and Susanna listened, fascinated, as they told of following Jake to the bookstore and of seeing Balazar and his gentleman pull up in front.
"Huh," Susanna said, "the very same bad boys. It's almost like a Dickens novel."
"Who is Dickens? And what is a novel?" Roland asked.
"A novel's a long story set down in a book," she said. "Dickens wrote about a dozen. He was maybe the best who ever lived. In his stories, folks in this big city called London kept meeting people they knew from other places or long ago. I had a teacher in college who hated the way that always happened. He said Dickens' stories were full of easy coincidences."
"A teacher who either didn't know about Ka or didn't believe in it," Roland said. Eddie was nodding.
"Yeah, this is Ka, all right. No doubt."
"I'm more interested in the woman who wrote Charlie the Choo-Choo than this storyteller Dickens," Roland said. "Jake, I wonder if you'd—"
"I'm way ahead of you,"
Jake said, unbuckling the straps of his pack. Almost reverently, he slid out the battered book telling the adventures of Charlie the Locomotive and his friend, Engineer Bob. They all looked at the cover. The name below the picture was still Beryl Evans.
"Man," Eddie said, "that is so weird. I mean, I don't want to get sidetracked or anything."
He paused, realizing he had just made a railroading pun, then went on. Roland wasn't very interested in puns and jokes anyway.
"But that is weird. The one Jake bought, Jake 77, was by Claudia something Bachman."
"Inez," Jake said. "Also, there was a Y, a lowercase y. Any of you know what that means?"
None of them did, but Roland said there had been names like it in Magus. "I believe it was some sort of added honorific. And I'm not sure it is to the side. Jake, you said the sign in the window was different from before. How?"
"I can't remember, but you know what? I think if you hypnotized me again, you know, with the bullet, I could."
"And in time I may," Roland said. "But this morning, time is short."
"Back to that again," Eddie thought. "Yesterday it hardly existed, and now it's short. But it's all about time somehow, isn't it? Roland's old days, our old days, and these new days? These dangerous new days?"
"Why?"
Susanna asked. "Our friends," Roland said, and nodded to the south. "I have a feeling they'll be making themselves known to us soon."
"Are they our friends?"
Jake asked. "That really is to the side," Roland said, and again wondered if that were really true. "For now, let's turn the mind of our Kef to this bookstore of the mind, or whatever it's called. You saw the Harriers from the Leaning Tower greensticking the owner, didn't you? This man Tower, or Torin."
"Pressuring him, you mean?" Eddie asked. "Twisting his arm?"
"Yes."
"Sure they were,"
Jake said.
"Where?"
Oi put in.
"Sure where?"
"Bet you anything that Tower and Torin are really the same name," Susanna said. "That Torin's Dutch for tower."
She saw Roland getting ready to speak and held up her hand.
"It's the way folks often do things in our bit of the universe, Roland. Change the foreign name to one that's more, well, American."
"Yeah," Eddie said.
"So Stemperwitz becomes Stamper, Yakov becomes Jacob, or—"
"Or Beryl Evans becomes Claudia E. Inez Bachman," Jake said.
He laughed, but didn't sound very amused. Eddie picked a half-burned stick out of the fire and began to doodle with it in the dirt. One by one, the great letters formed. C. L. A. U.
"Big Nose even said Tower was Dutch. A squarehead's always a squarehead, right, boss?"
He looked at Jake for confirmation. Jake nodded, then took the stick and continued on with it. D. I. A.
"Him being Dutch makes a lot of sense, you know," Susanna said. "At one time, the Dutch owned most of Manhattan."
"You want another Dickens touch?" Jake asked.
He wrote Y in the dirt after Claudia, then looked up at Susanna.
How about the haunted house where I came through into this world?
The mansion, Eddie said.
The mansion in Dutch Hill, Jake said.
Dutch Hill, yeah, that's right, God damn. Let's go to the core, Roland said. I think it's the agreement paper you saw, and you felt you had to see it, didn't you? Eddie nodded. Did your need feel like a part of following the beam?
Roland, I think it was the beam.
The way to the tower, in other words.
Yeah, Eddie said.
He was thinking about the way clouds flowed along the beam, the way shadows bent along the beam, the way every twig of every tree seemed to turn in its direction. All things serve the beam, Roland had told him, and Eddie's need to see the paper Balazar had put in front of Calvin Tower had felt like a need, harsh and imperative. Tell me what it said. Eddie bit his lip. He didn't feel as scared about this as he had about carving the key, which had ultimately allowed them to rescue Jake and pull him through to this side, but it was close. Because like the key, this was important. If he forgot something, worlds might crash.
Man, I can't remember it all, not word for word.
Roland made an impatient gesture. If I need that, I'll hypnotize you and get it word for word.
Do you think it matters?
Susanna asked. I think it all matters, Roland said.
What if hypnosis doesn't work on me? Eddie asked. What if I'm not, like, a good subject?
Leave that to me, Roland said.
19,
Jake said abruptly. They all turned toward him. He was looking at the letters he and Eddie had drawn in the dirt beside the dead campfire.
Claudia E. Inez Backman. 19 letters.
3. Roland considered for a moment, then let it pass. If the number 19 was somehow part of this, its meaning would declare itself in time. For now, there were other matters. The paper, he said. Let's stay with that for now. Tell me everything about it you can remember.
Well, it was a legal agreement, with the seal at the bottom and everything.
Eddie paused, struck by a fairly basic question. Roland probably got this part of it. He'd been a kind of law enforcement officer after all, but it wouldn't hurt to be sure.
You know about lawyers, don't you?
Roland spoke in his driest tone. You forget that I came from Gilead, Eddie, the most inner of the inner baronies. We had more merchants and farmers and manufacturers than lawyers, I think, but the count would have been close.
Susanna laughed. You make me think of a scene from Shakespeare, Roland. Two characters, might have been Falstaff and Prince Hal, I'm not sure, are talking about what they're going to do when they win the war and take over, and one of them says, first we'll kill all the lawyers.
It would be a fairish way to start, Roland said. And Eddie found his thoughtful tone rather chilling. Then the gunslinger turned to him again. Go on. If you can add anything, Jake, please do, and relax, both of you, for your father's sakes. For now, I only want a sketch. Eddie supposed he'd known that, but hearing Roland say it made him feel better.
All right.
It was a memorandum of agreement. That was right at the top in big letters. At the bottom it said agreed to, and there were two signatures. One was Calvin Tower, the other was Richard someone. Do you remember, Jake?
Sayre,
Jake said.
Richard Patrick Sayre.
He paused briefly, lips moving, then nodded.
19 letters.
And what did it say, this agreement? Roland asked.
Not all that much, if you want to know the truth, Eddie said. Or that's what it seemed like to me, anyway. Basically, it said that Tower owned a vacant lot on the corner of 46th Street and 2nd Avenue.
The vacant lot, Jake said. The one with the rose in it.
Yeah, that one. Anyway, Tower signed this agreement on July 15th, 1976. Sombra Corporation gave him $100,000. What he gave them, so far as I could tell, was a promise not to sell the lot to anyone but Sombra for the next year, to take care of it, pay the taxes and such, and then to give Sombra first right of purchase, assuming he hadn't sold it to them by then anyway. Which he hadn't when we were there, but the agreement still had a month and a half to run.
Mr. Tower said the $100,000 was all spent, Jake put in.
Was there anything in the agreement about this Sombra Corporation having a topping privilege?
Susanna asked. Eddie and Jake thought it over, exchanged a glance, then shook their heads.
Sure? Susanna asked. Not quite, but pretty sure, Eddie said. You think it matters?
I don't know, Susanna said. The kind of agreement you're talking about, well, without a topping privilege, it just doesn't seem to make sense. What does it boil down to when you stop to think about it? I, Calvin Tower, agree to think about selling you my vacant lot. You pay me $100,000, and I'll think about it for a whole year. When I'm not drinking coffee and playing chess with my friends, that is, and when the year's up, maybe I'll sell it to you, and maybe I'll keep it, and maybe I'll just auction it off to the highest bidder. And if you don't like it, sweet cheeks, you just go spit.
You're forgetting something, Roland said mildly.
Why? Susanna asked.
This sombre is no ordinary law-abiding combination. Ask yourself if an ordinary law-abiding combination would hire someone like Balazar to carry their messages.
You have a point, Eddie said. Tower was mucho scared.
Anyway, Jake said, it makes at least a few things clearer. The sign I saw in the vacant lot, for instance. This Sombra company also got the right to advertise forthcoming projects there for their 100,000. Did you see that part, Eddie?
I think so, right after the part about Tower not permitting any liens or encumbrances on his property because of Sombra's stated interest, wasn't it?
Right, Jake said. The sign I saw in the lot said...
He paused, thinking, then raised his hands and looked between them as if reading a sign only he could see.
Mills Construction and Sombra Real Estate Associates are continuing to remake the face of Manhattan, and then, coming soon, Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums.
So that's what they want it for, Eddie said. Condos, but what are condominiums?
Susanna asked, frowning. It sounds like some newfangled kind of spice rack.
It's a kind of co-op apartment deal, Eddie said. They probably had them in your Wen, but by a different name.
Yeah, Susanna said with some asperity. We called them co-ops. Or sometimes we went way downtown and called them apartment buildings.
It doesn't matter because it was never about condos, Jake said. Never about the building the sign said they were going to put there, for that matter. All that's only, you know, shoot, what's the word?
Camouflage, Roland suggested. Jake grinned.
Camouflage, yeah, it's about the rose, not the building. And they can't get at it until they own the ground it grows on, I'm sure of it.
You may be right about the buildings not meaning anything, Susanna said, but that Turtle Bay name has a certain resonance, wouldn't you say?
She looked at the gunslinger. That part of Manhattan is called Turtle Bay, Roland.
He nodded, unsurprised. The turtle was one of the 12 guardians, and almost certainly stood at the far end of the beam upon which they now traveled.
The people from Mills Construction might not know about the rose, Jake said, but I bet the ones from Sombra Corporation do.
His hand stole into Oi's fur, which was thick enough at the Billy Bumbler's neck to make his fingers disappear entirely.
I think that somewhere in New York City, in some business building, probably in Turtle Bay on the east side, there's a door marked Sombra Corporation, and someplace behind that door, there's another door, the kind that takes you here.
For a minute, they sat thinking about it. About worlds spinning on a single axle in dying harmony. And no one said anything. 4.
Here's what I think is happening, Eddie said. Suze, Jake, feel free to step in if you think I'm getting it wrong. This guy, Cal Towers, some sort of custodian for the Rose. He may not know it on a conscious level, but he must be. Him and maybe his whole family before him. It explains the name.
Only he's the last, Jake said.
You can't be sure of that, hon, Susanna said.
No wedding ring, Jake responded.
And Susanna nodded, giving him that one at least provisionally.
Maybe at one time there were lots of Torrens owning lots of New York property, Eddie said. But those days are gone. Now the only thing standing between the Sombra Corporation and the Rose is one nearly broke fat guy who changed his name. He's a... what do you call someone who loves books?
A bibliophile, Susanna said.
Yeah, one of those. And George Biondi may not be Einstein, but he said at least one smart thing while we were eavesdropping. He said Tower's place wasn't a real shop, but just a hole you poured money into. What's going on with him is a pretty old story where we come from, Roland. When my ma used to see some rich guy on TV,
Donald Trump, for instance?
Who? Susanna asked.
You don't know him. He would have been just a kid back in 64, and it doesn't matter. Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, my mother would tell us. It's the American way, boys. So here's Tower, and he's sort of like Roland, the last of his line. He sells off a piece of property here and a piece there, making his taxes, making his house payments, keeping up with the credit cards and the doctor bills, paying for his stock, and yeah, I'm making this up, except somehow it doesn't feel that way.
No, Jake said. He spoke in a low, fascinated voice. It doesn't.
Perhaps you shared his kef, Roland said. More likely, you touched him. As my old friend Alain used to. Go on, Eddie.
And every year he tells himself the bookstore will turn around, catch on, maybe, the way things in New York sometimes do. Get out of the red and into the black, and then he'll be okay. And finally, there's only one thing left to sell, lot 298 on block 19 in Turtle Bay.
298 adds up to 19, Susanna said. I wish I could decide if that means something or if it's just blue car syndrome.
What's blue car syndrome? Jake asked.
When you buy a blue car, you see blue cars everywhere.
Not here you don't, Jake said. Not here,
Oi put in, and they all looked at him. Days, sometimes whole weeks would go by, and Oi would do nothing but give out the occasional echo of their talk. Then he would say something that might almost have been the product of original thought. But you didn't know, not for sure. Not even Jake knew for sure.
The way we don't know for sure about 19, Susanna thought, and gave the bumbler a pat on the head. Oi responded with a companionable wink.
He holds on to that lot until the bitter end, Eddie said. I mean, hey, he doesn't even own the crappy building his bookstores, and he only leases it.
Jake took over.
Tom and Jerry's artistic deli goes out of business, and Tower has it torn down, because part of him wants to sell the lot. That part of him says he'd be crazy not to.
Jake fell silent for a moment, thinking about how some thoughts came in the middle of the night, crazy thoughts, crazy ideas, and voices that wouldn't shut up.
But there's another part of him, another voice.
The voice of the turtle, Susanna put in quietly.
Yes, the turtle or the beam, Jake agreed. They're probably the same thing, and this voice tells him he has to hold on to it at all costs.
He looked at Eddie.
Do you think he knows about the rose? Do you think he goes down there sometimes and looks at it?
Does a rabbit shit in the woods? Eddie responded. Sure he goes, and sure he knows. On some level he must know, because a corner lot in Manhattan, how much would a thing like that be worth, Susanna?
In my time, probably $1 million, she said. By 1977, God knows, 3, 5?
She shrugged.
Enough to let Cy Tower go on selling books at a loss for the rest of his life, provided he was reasonably careful about how he invested the principal.
Eddie said, everything about this points up how reluctant he is to sell. I mean, Sue's already pointed out how little Sombra got for their $100,000.
But they did get something, Roland said. Something very important.
A foot in the door, Eddie said.
You say true. And now, as the term of their agreement winds down, they send your world's version of the big coffin hunters, hard caliber boys. If greed or necessity doesn't compel Tower to sell them the land with the rose on it, they'll terrify him into it.
Yeah, Jake said.
And who would stand on Tower's side? Maybe Aaron Deepnow? Maybe no one.
So what do we do?
Buy it ourselves, Susanna said promptly.
Of course.